Good morning, everyone. I hope you are in the right place. We are here to hang out with the president. That's the name of our session. If you wouldn't mind going ahead and taking your seats, we have quite a program planned for you this morning. And so we'd like to go ahead and get started. My name is Sharon Conrad, and I am the Director of Education at the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza in Dallas. You heard some of you, I believe, a presentation by our director yesterday. And so I will be continuing that part of the conversation in terms of what our museum is up to, But we are talking today about hanging out with the president, using new technologies in presidential education. And that we thought that this was a terrific topic for this session because with the conference theme being Beyond the Presidency, Historical Context, and Modern Reality, so many of us are thinking about the many ways we need to integrate technology and digital access into what we do. And the panel that you see up here is primarily interested in education. So we're, for the most part, educators, and so we're going to be talking about how we have been integrating technology into what we do to reach students, teachers, and audiences of all kind. As you all know, technology offers history institutions both challenges and opportunities. And as educators, we embrace this opportunity because so many of our students are tasked with making use of the 21st century skills. And so we see this as an opportunity to bring our rich, vast, diverse resources and primary sources into classrooms all over the community, state, nation, and yes, even all over the world. And so I am pleased to be the session chair today, and what I want to do is basically give you a very, very brief rundown on how things are going to go. You're going to hear from five different institutions talking about how they are using technology to make the history come alive at our sites. Two of us are going to focus primarily on programs that use technology, and three of us are going to be thinking about and talking about how technology is being used to deliver those programs. And so you'll be hearing a number of different perspectives. One of our presenters, I'm really excited to have him with us today, is going to be sharing a unique resource for every history educator should know about for sharing resources. And so you'll be hearing from him, and I will introduce each of our panelists in just a moment. And then we have a special presentation because we have an interactive video conference that we're going to do live for you. We're going to be bringing you a presentation from Dickinson State University in North Dakota. And so you are going to be our classroom today at the conclusion of our formal remarks and before we get into a Q&A session. So sit back and enjoy. We're going to save time, like I said, for questions. So hold on to those as best you can. And as Bob said on the first day of this conference, that it's important that you think of how you can make connections to your site as you listen to each of us. We know that we're all very different, but if you're thinking about how you might bend these ideas to what you need to do back in your communities, you probably will take away a great deal, we hope. So with that, to my left is James Yasko. He has been the Director of Education and Interpretation at the Hermitage, home of President Andrew Jackson, for over 5 years. He manages an education staff of 18 different education modules that are offered through on-site programming, traveling classroom, and video conferencing at the site. Prior to coming to Nashville, James managed the on-site education program and video conferencing efforts at the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum in Cooperstown, New York, and he delivered up to 450 video conferences per year. And he asked me to just add on here that he loves his 2-year-old daughter, his wife of 11 years, and the Houston Astros, but not necessarily in that order. Next we have Miss Sarah Jenks with us. Sarah is Director of Education at Ford's Theater. Sarah has almost 20 years of experience in the arts and education fields as professional and as professional development director with the New York State Council on the Arts Empire State Partnerships, Initiative. She served as a classroom teacher and school administrator and is the founder of Ford's Theater Education Programs, where she served as director for almost 7 years. She's initiated a wide range of local and national programs at Ford's and has served in a leadership role for both students and teachers there. And she comes to us with training from Harvard University Graduate School of Education and the American Civilization Program at Brown University. We have next to Sarah, Mr. Mark Adams. Mark is the education specialist at the Harry S. Truman Library and Museum. He's a history educator with more than 20 years of experience. He has taught at the high school and university levels. He's created and implemented history education and outreach programs for both the Kansas Museum of History and the Harry S. Truman Library and Museum. He's coordinated the National History Day programs and workshops at the state and or regional level for the past 23 years. And next to Mark, we have James Worley. James is director of the National K-20 Initiative and Internet 2. James serves as director of that, which brings together Internet 2 member institutions and innovators from public libraries, primary and secondary schools, colleges and universities, and museums to extend advanced broadband-enabled technologies, applications, middleware, and content to all community anchor institutions as quickly and as connectedly as possible. And I'm going to let him explain what that means as part of his presentation. We are very, very excited to have James with us today because he has tools that we all need to be aware of, and so we're thrilled to have him with us. And through James's efforts, we have been very, very happy to be able to connect with Dickinson State University and the Theodore Roosevelt Center in North Dakota. We have Sharon. Where is Sharon Kaiser? She's over there. She's going to introduce our presenter from Dickinson State so that you get a sense for all this amazing technology that we'll be talking about and see it live and in action. And I'm hoping, Scott, we're hoping that we can make sure that happens. And this is actually a very important piece of it. And we'll be talking about, you know, technology is an amazing tool, but it is also a tricky thing to kind of get your hands on and make sure that it always works in your favor. And so we are at the mercy of technology today, and hopefully all will go well. So with that, we wanted to begin with I will begin by telling you a little bit about what we're doing at the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza in Dallas. And as you heard yesterday, we are the site of the Kennedy assassination. We are in the building that you see on the screen here at the corner of Elm and Houston, the Texas School Book Depository building. And it presents a lot of challenges to tell this amazing story. We have this photo of the Kennedys disembarking at Love Field just over 50 years ago. It's an amazing story, and we are honored to tell the story, but it does present challenges because it is not a happy story. It's not a celebratory story. It is a challenging story, and so it's not necessarily something that every school is ready to tackle. It does raise some tough issues, and we work primarily with fifth grade and up students to convey this. We deal with the assassination, but also President Kennedy's legacy and the legacy of the assassination. And so it's a complicated story. It's one that we are earnest in trying to present in the best way possible, but it is definitely a challenge for conveying some of the complexities of what it means. One of the things that we have done, and just over the past 4 years, I've been at the museum for 7 years this month, and we have an amazing audio-guided tour that every visitor to our museum receives, but what we don't always offer is the opportunity for our visitors to interact with our staff. And so we have been developing programs that are post-tour programs that are available to schools, but it's limited. We don't have a lot of space. When we do educational programs, it takes up some of our multi-purpose space, and so we have developed a video conference program as a way to reach schools, not just in Texas, but all over the country and even beyond. And one of the things that we try to do as much as possible is, we've been lucky, is that we have a service in Texas that's known as Connect to Texas. It's a office out of the Texas Education Agency that allows us, they serve as our bridging and marketing service for our video conferencing effort. And through them, we are able to connect with schools literally all over the world. One of the things that, one of the things that we do in that program is we have a program that we call Conflicting Evidence, where we try to get students to look at the primary source material and really assess how the same piece of evidence can be used to tell two different stories. And so this is one. This is the type of photo that we use to talk a lot about specifically Lee Harvey Oswald and how evidence has been used by both people trying to frame his guilt, but also those trying to say that he was not guilty of shooting President Kennedy, and looking at these pieces of evidence from multiple perspectives and getting the students on the other end of our connections to do that with us. We have our connection equipment looks like what you see on the screen. It's a monitor with a camera on it, and where there's a microphone, and it plugs into the internet, and it allows us to have these conversations. What you're seeing on the screen now is a Q&A that we've done with Abbotsley School in Australia. They were one of the first schools that we tested with, and they study the Kennedy assassination in depth.
To do some teacher professional development. But most recently, and if we get a
mentioned, North Texas students. And students were encouraged to record 10-minute oral history interviews and submit those videos to us via YouTube and online and however essentially they could get it to us. And then we compiled those videos into one compilation video that we now have on our YouTube channel. And so when you have access to your devices, and I encourage you to check it out because it's a great way of kind of finding the kids where they are. They're very, very sophisticated with the technology, and we're trying as much as possible to get them to think about how they can use that technology to access our materials and to share the history that they're finding in their own communities. So with that, I'm going to, even though we do not have yet access to the PowerPoint, I'm going to turn it over to James to talk a little bit about what's happening at the Hermitage.
Good morning. So just to kind of give you a little bit of a roadmap into how we got to what we're doing at the Hermitage, I got involved in video conferencing in 2003 working at the Grace Museum in Abilene, Texas. And I was 23 years old, and I got involved in video conferencing mainly because I was 23. And I could kind of fumble my way through the settings to get it to where there could actually be some sort of a connection. We got a grant to purchase this massive mobile video conferencing cart. It was great. It had to be plugged into the wall. We didn't have Wi-Fi. The microphone was on top of the monitor, which is about 10 feet away. And so at that point, do you want to? Okay.
Not really. No, I will quickly say that here's just an image showing Dr. Sabato with the students in our media center, and another one with a Time Magazine photojournalist where the students got to share their photos with a internationally renowned photographer. So those are just some of those programs that I was talking with you a little bit about. With that, I'm going to turn it back over to James.
So at the Hall of Fame, at the Grace, the microphone was actually mounted on the monitor, which is about 10 feet away. And so it's at that point that I had to learn how to shout at the microphone. And even though I have a microphone for the last 8 or 9 years, I've had some sort of microphone very much closer to my actual mouth. I cannot help but shout. It's this learned behavior where the first question I always get, no matter what, in every video conference is, do you think you could turn your microphone down a little bit? Because I'm just yelling into a microphone. So that's where I sort of became a little bit more familiar with video conferencing. And my wife and I moved to Cooperstown and worked at the Hall of Fame, and I managed the video conferencing program there. And they had a massive setup. It was a mobile cart that could go into the exhibit space. You were sort of set up near an object or an artifact that helped kind of tell the story of the program, whatever program you were delivering, which was cool for the students, but it was a little bit problematic because it always drew a crowd, which was fine, but there that also meant that there was a bigger risk of physical audience interaction with, you know, a Mets fan, always a Mets fan, who thought that you were talking directly to them and didn't understand that, hey, I've kind of got something going on with some kids over here. Don't answer the questions, please. It's great that you know what, you know, the batting average is. Stop answering the question. The setup was pretty intense. It was very elaborate. A 45-minute video conference, you'd have to start setting up, you know, an hour beforehand, get everything connected, make sure the connection worked, and then you'd wait, and sometimes it would work. A lot of times it didn't, and then breaking down took another half hour after that. So a 45-minute connection would take upwards of 2 hours. So coming to the Hermitage, and we'll come back to little Andrew here in a second. In the mansion, if you've been to the mansion at the Hermitage, the walking space is not that large. Like the physical space where if we were to buy a mobile cart, it would be in the way. And because we have tours ongoing throughout the day, then there's no way, especially with my loud, natural shouting voice, that I wouldn't interrupt whatever tours were going on, and the kids on the other side would hear the interpreters, and it would just be a big mess. So that's sort of what we kind of had to contend with. And Sarah's going to talk about the cost of the video conferencing unit that you're probably familiar with, or at least know that it's a pretty large amount. with our staffing, you know, it's me, it's a full-time educator, and we have a part-time educator as well. It wasn't feasible to commit tens of thousands of dollars to a mobile cart that would only be in the way, that would take 2 hours out of my day, because we kind of need to run a little bit of a tighter ship. And so what we decided on was to spend $50 on a USB headset, $35 on a USB camera, and we use a company called Field Trip Zoom, which every time I talk about Field Trip Zoom, people think I'm like a paid sponsor, and I'm not. It's just a great, they're a great company to work with. And then we have a coffee, I have a coffee budget as well to help with that. But what Field Trip Zoom allows us to do is to connect at my desk in our education building, which is separate. No one's typically going to walk through there. I bother my coworkers that I share an office space with, but I'm not really concerned about that. What it does is it turns my desktop into a video conferencing unit that can make those IP connections to schools that have the big video conferencing unit. And it works in such a way that they have no idea that I'm at my desk. I have a big American flag to cover up the mess that's behind the American flag in my office, but that's the backdrop. You can see sort of on the right the window that kind of pops up, that's me, and that's the American flag in the background. But if a school does not have video conferencing capability, like if they don't have one of those huge video conferencing units, there's a web option where you can send them a link that they click that shows them the exact same thing. So it's flexible. The unlimited license with Field Trip Zoom costs less than $1,000. And pricing it out, we realized if the price point stayed the same, we could get 15 years of use of at least 15 years of a license with Field Trip Zoom for the same cost as buying a basic video conferencing unit. So it really worked for us. In that it helped with our financial constraints, it helped with our staffing constraints, and within 30 seconds of a video conferencing ending, I'm back on, you know, I'm at my desk, so I'm back checking email and answering teacher questions. So it just made a lot more sense for us. Now, I'll come back to that in a second. Working at the Hermitage presents kind of a unique challenge because, and I know this is going to be brand new information, and it's going to be shocking to you, Andrew Jackson is not the most popular president in the world. And so, which puts us in a weird position because, you know, our programs, we have 8 or 9 different programs that students can access and teachers can access through video conferencing. But our two most popular programs are our programs on the Trail of Tears and Andrew Jackson's role in Native American removal and slavery at the Hermitage. Which really does a number on your emotional state when that's all you talk about is Native American removal and slavery. But that's what teachers want. And whether that's because they want us to deliver the unfortunate news about Native American removal and that Andrew Jackson was a slave owner, or because they just have to. And it works for us because Jackson fits into the social studies curriculum, depending on your state, in 4th grade, 5th grade, 8th grade, 11th, and then we can get into some kind of higher level government topics in 12th grade as well. And so, you know, it's an interesting challenge to, you know, when you're sort of tasked with explaining to students why were the Native Americans removed and what role did Andrew Jackson have, without trying to sound like you're trying to get Jackson off the hook, because that's not the point at all. That's not the focus of that program. But to tell it in a way where, you know, you kind of have to say up front, or we have to say up front, look, I know I work at the Hermitage. It doesn't mean that we can't sort of shy away from the actual history. So it does kind of put us in a unique position where we can help kind of not necessarily steer the narrative away from Andrew Jackson, but at least provide some context to the time period. One thing I did want to point out real quick is our Andrew Jackson mapping project. It's interactive to a point. But we have embedded a Google Earth map onto one of the pages in the education section of our website. We spent about 2 years going through biographies, and we're still going through primary sources to map as closely as we can the exact locations where Andrew Jackson, where something happened related to Andrew Jackson, to the intersection if we can. So, you know, there's over 300 place marks on the map, and we're continuing to add to it. But it has, you click on the little place mark, and it pops up what it is, a description, and the source that we use to kind of map it exactly where it is. So that's been, it's just something, it took a really long time. And so I kind of promote it every chance I get. So and then once we get to the Q&A, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
About, because you've been hearing about the sort of more standard, this one standard video conferencing field trip model. We do that as well at Ford's Theater. We do two experiences. One we call a virtual field trip. It's a bit of a misnomer. We don't actually have the capacity, just like James was saying, to take people through the space because of our visitation. We have a very small footprint in downtown Washington, and we have visitation of about 650,000 a year. So because of that, it's wonderful that we have all those visitors, but it does limit what we can do in our space. So what we've done instead is we've developed a couple of options to explore the conspiracy and to explore the moment of the assassination and Civil War Washington as part of, as an option for schools to, and in fact senior centers, who want to do a video conference with us. So we do that, we agree, and it's been a big issue for us that it's very, very time intensive. We ultimately only serve also through that program about 800 students a year. And for us, because of the amount of staff time involved in creating those trips, you have to do tech calls, test calls in advance, and we have about 250,000 students who come to the site every year. That's a very small number, and honestly, it's hard for me to make an argument at times to our director and to the board, the education committee, that's a really good use of staff time. I want to present a couple of other ways of using technology to reach students that we've been using. Some of them are very intensive, both time intensive and intensive in terms of the number of hours of contact time. But they've given us incredible ambassadors around the country, teacher ambassadors who would do anything for us and go and speak for us and are really powerful links for us. And then in addition to that, I want to talk about some of the things that we're in the process of trying to develop now because we're anticipating the 150th anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's assassination and the end of the Civil War next spring. And I'm going to just introduce you to some of those. And part of what our aim is with those is to develop web resources that I would call asynchronous, in that we don't have to be at every moment available in the same way that we are with the point-to-point video conferencing. So to begin with, we are a working theater as well as being a National Historic Site and a museum. As a result of that, we have a staff of playwrights and a lot of expertise in theater, in performance. So one of the big things that we do is we focus on oratory. This was one of Abraham Lincoln's greatest leadership tools, and it's really allowed us to combine what we do with leadership, what we do with Abraham Lincoln, what we do with theater. And as the biggest program and it's honestly the one that's closest to my heart, that we do is called the National Oratory Fellows Program. We work with teachers who have found us and already connected with us somehow over the course of a whole year in their classrooms. And we do it with teachers all around the country. So we have a teacher we work with all year long, two teachers in Independence, Missouri. We have teachers in Wichita, Kansas. We have teachers in Idaho, Nebraska, et cetera. And we partner with them. We put a teaching artist online with them all throughout the year for about a total of 10 hours of classroom contact time and also about 10 hours of co-planning time. And then the two student delegates and the teacher come to Washington in May. And they go through master classes and professional development, and then the students and teachers get to perform speeches, either original speeches or historical speeches, on the stage of Ford's Theater. As you can imagine, this is a really in-depth program that requires, we actually have a staff member who's probably about three-quarters time dedicated to this program. We work with 14 teachers right now. That number is growing. And in fact, we've applied for a Department of Education grant to expand it considerably, but it's very intensive. Again, the outcome that works for us is that it gives us these incredible ambassadors who will do anything for us, and that's enormously valuable in terms of being a national site. So this program, we do planning, we do video in-classroom contact time very regularly, and what we've ended up being able to offer is essentially a long-term residency that's entirely virtual in a school. And we were very lucky because we had a capital campaign just about 5 years ago now. In that capital campaign, I was able to slip in video conferencing equipment as part of what was being built because we had an education, they were building this thing they called the Education and Leadership Center. And I said, well, if it's the Education and Leadership Center, you better make sure that we're going to be serving people around the country. How are you going to do that? Well, we have an IP-based video conferencing system now. However, not everyone does. So we use also Skype. And I, by the way you're going to see this is like the worst practice in terms of PowerPoint because there are almost no images. The reason for that is that there's a lot of technology programs. I want you all to be able to see the names of them so you can either write them down if you like or that you have a visual memory. For me, that's really important. So we use zoom.us. And we also use Basecamp, which is a cloud-based project management system that allows all of the teachers and the teaching artists and our staff to communicate with one another regularly, sort of a combination of a listserv and a cloud-based document system. The big takeaway for me, the biggest takeaway of all, is don't just do a program for the sake of doing a distance learning program. Make sure that you know what your goals are, and make sure that your goals are and your programs are already proven and strong, and then figure out what technology is going to work for you to do those programs and to serve the people that it's your goal to serve. And if you don't do that, you will find yourselves scrambling to do things that are mission that are creeping your mission further and further away. Technology can become your ruler if you let it, and even accidentally, you may not mean for it to. Make sure your programs have strong goals, and then let the technology help you to accomplish those. So we have this program where 12 middle school teachers in 8 states in the District of Columbia, 6 teaching artists, about 700 students around the country, and our 2 administrators in DC. And those are the people that need to communicate with each other on a regular basis, on a very regular basis. And here are some of the things that they do. You know, in May, they perform on the Ford stage. They practice at the Lincoln Memorial. And you can see here our video conferencing system. That's a camera on top. We have a green screen, which is important, and I'm going to come back to that. It's just a wall painted green, but it allows us to project images behind us so we can use historical images in telling stories. And then you can see the classroom on the other side. We need those teaching artists in the classrooms. We can't afford to fly them there. How are we going to do that? And we need regular teaching planning sessions between teaching artists and classroom teachers. So here are some of the things that we've done. We use the IP-based video conferencing. We've used Skype, FaceTime, Google Chat. These are all great resources. You probably know most of them, but just think about how they can easily be adjusted to your needs. Almost all of those have screen sharing capacity. You can use that as a way to share historical images, historical documents. And then we really make great use of phone calls and emails. And you've got to create options because nobody's going to need the same thing. And that's something that we're learning with our IP-based video conferencing system. We're still trying to figure out how to deal with some of the issues that exist because IP-based video conferencing is somewhat limited. Okay, so we get teaching artists into the classroom, we do regular planning sessions, and then we also do these monthly group meetings between administrators, teachers, and teaching artists. We don't do group meetings where we fly everybody in. We have to figure out a way to do it. But we want them to be face-to-face because we found when we did conference calls, people get distracted. So we started trying to use Skype. Well, Skype is great, but it wasn't the best for group calls. People were getting would get cut out a lot when we had 10 people on the call. It looks like the Brady Bunch. You've got all the little tiles. So next we tried Google Hangouts. Again, Google Hangouts are great. The thing about Google Hangouts is that if you're not doing a Google Hangout on air, which means you're broadcasting out and not everyone can communicate back to you, you can only have up to 10 people on the call. And we were getting to the point where we wanted more like 16 to 20 people on the call. And so Google Hangouts were okay, but they weren't really serving our needs. So then we found this great thing called BlueJeans. BlueJeans is the best. It's amazing. You can use the green screen with it. The problem with BlueJeans is that it costs $10,000 a year for a license. We can't pay that. We did use it for a month with a free trial and loved it. And we were like, this is the best thing. Can't pay the price. So BlueJeans was out. Zoom.us has been our solution. It's really a beautiful, very simple, internet-based or IP-based system. We can't use the green screen with it, which is frustrating, but that's okay. We still can use screen share, and it allows us to have, I think, up to 25 participants online. And it's, but I'll show you a little bit more about cost in a moment. So the thing about this is we would go online, different members of our team would go online all the time and just keep searching for new options. And that's how we found these things, is keep searching for new options, get on listservs for connectedlearning.us, for all different kinds of listservs. And that's the way that we found all of these solutions. It was just by searching. Lastly, we needed a place for everyone to share their resources so that they could be saved for evaluation, so we have documentation, and so that we can have conversations. Okay, we tried Dropbox. Dropbox is great for documents. It doesn't do anything beyond that. So we still use it for some things. Google Drive can be helpful in terms of sharing writing, right? But again, Wiki Spaces, I don't know, have any of you ever used a Wiki Space? Wiki Spaces are cool because you can post documents and you can create all these different little sections, but they have frustrating settings around how to have people get notified when changes are made. And so we found that that didn't really work because people didn't participate because they weren't hearing from one another on a regular basis. They had to go to the site and check it. This was the same problem with Ning.com. Solution has been Basecamp. Basecamp.com is a place that you can create a setting or a site that allows people to actually post videos of students performing. It allows you to post documents that you want to share, articles. You can create separate folders. But then in addition, you have a calendar. You have access to a calendar, and you have access to discussion. And the great thing is it sort of serves like a listserv, so that if you post something to the site, it arrives to everybody's inbox. And then when they hit reply, it goes back to everybody. So instead of that thing where people have to post and go to the site, you can communicate with one another from your email box. And that has made a huge difference in the active participation of the group. So again, just make sure you're continually paying attention to your community's needs. If you consider how you can make those relationships with teachers around the country. It's continuing to build those relationships. And when the teachers who came to our Summer Institute said, we want to stay in touch, saying, well, how can we do that? Hey, maybe we can develop this other program that allowed us to make this community of ambassadors around the country. And they are truly our biggest cheerleaders. So what does it cost? I mentioned BlueJeans cost $10,000 a year. Obviously, that's a no-go for, I would think, for pretty much anyone. IP-based video conferencing, you can go online, you could spend much less, like $10,000, but probably you would end up spending more like $45,000, and this isn't even a mobile cart. So we're still working on trying to figure out how to do something that's mobile. However, for Zoom.us subscription, it's $9.99 a month, and Basecamp subscription is $9.99 a month. So you have those two put together. And then in addition to those two, we did actually make a decision that we were going to support some of our teacher partners in getting them decent webcams and microphone headsets because they weren't buying them themselves and it was impossible to see the kids for the teaching artists. And we sort of thought, okay, we're going to take a little bit of money here and put it towards technology for those teachers so that we can have the kind of interaction that's ultimately going to be meaningful. And we were able to get grant funding to support that. So that's our National Oratory Fellows Program, and that's the most intensive thing we do. I want to talk briefly about some things that we do that are much less intensive, and we have an intern this summer who's working with us to develop a Google Cultural Institute platform. How many of you have heard of Google Cultural Institute? Anyone? Google Cultural Institute, and I know Eileen, I see Eileen back there, and I know that they were actually part of a Gettysburg Address, Google Cultural Institute exhibit around the 150th of the Gettysburg Address, because they have one of the copies of it. Google Cultural Institute is a project of Google, the company Google, that is free, completely free, and what they want to do, and this is sort of in the Google take over the world, but don't be evil, wheelhouse, is that they want to, through their search engine, make available resources from historic sites, art museums, all different kinds of institutions around the world, and they then integrate it into their search system so that whenever anyone searches for you via Google, these are the things that come up along with your website. So you can upload any digitized images you have, any at all, and you can they also have something called a gigapixel, which you may have heard of covered in the news. And the gigapixel goes so fine detail into, so close into it that you'll see, you can see every little brush stroke. They also do a street view where you go into the museum and see the exhibits. So basically, this is the Computer History Museum one. You can see lots of other historic moments. And I think this is worth knowing about because it's free. It's completely free. All you have to do is provide the labor. And then look at what other sites are doing around virtual field trips. Yep. Oh, and there's my contact info.
It's always the last slide, right?
Right.
Okay. Do you have the mic on me now?
All right. Morning, everybody. I'm Mark Adams, Education Director at Truman Library, and I kind of wear two hats there. My official title is Education Specialist. I also run the Truman Library's website, so I tend to come at things with a kind of a technology mindset, even though I'm a history teacher in the past of high school history. So our goals at the Truman Library with technology is to, and particularly with history education, is to try and use primary sources in the classroom. So statically within our own building and within our own community, we're only 20 minutes from Kansas City. We have 13 school districts within our metropolitan area. Traditionally, we've done, you know, those classroom presentations, bringing students into the museum and library and doing traditional educational programs. Over the last 5 years or so, teachers have started to come to us, you know, from different parts of the country. We've seen your website. We've seen some of the documents you have online. We'd love to interact with you. And so we haven't really created a formal program with a name or put a tag on it or anything like that, but we've just kind of tried to respond to the need as those calls and emails come in. It's accelerated a lot in the last 18 months or so, and so now we're beginning to think a little bit more strategically, and this session in of itself and the planning of this session has been really beneficial for me personally to think about how we can do that. Our goals really are kind of selfish. We want the students to use our primary source documents, and because they're in different parts of the country, the main part of the way they're going to do that is through our website. We're fortunate over the last decade or more that we've got 30,000 documents digitized and online. We have 30,000 photographs digitized and online, all in databases and all completely searchable. So we have a rich resource on Truman and Truman's presidency and his early life that we can draw on. So we have that content is there, it's just letting people know about it. So in some ways, some of our video conferencing has been more PR, and some of it has been to try and engage those students using our primary sources and then teaching them how to analyze them just like we would if a student was to come into the classroom in our Truman Library physically. So we've kind of tried to match up with what we've done physically online, and as Sarah mentioned, that doesn't always work out the same, and I'm going to talk a little bit about how we've had to adjust due to the technology to make that a little bit more interactive than it might otherwise would be. As a result of doing that, we've got a couple of other audiences that have come to us, senior citizens groups. I know two of our speakers have already mentioned that. So I'll talk a little about what we've done with those senior citizens groups. And another group is teacher workshops, teacher professional development, and we've done a fair amount with those. So those have kind of been our goals. So I just wanted to kind of let you know about some of the technology we've used. And then really more importantly, probably for you, for this particular audience, is kind of the lessons learned in terms of mistakes we've made, things we've learned along the way, and hopefully you can kind of skip some of those steps and go straight to being an excellent program. So we've tried a few different things. We have a Polycom unit. We've had a Polycom unit for a long time. It still works, and sometimes schools can use that, so we can connect that way. Often when teachers contact us, our first question to them is, what's the best way to connect with you? Once they tell us what that is, then we make it work, rather than us dictating to them, hey, we can only do it this way. So you really need to be flexible. And so you've heard about some of the options already, so I don't want to belabor some of that, but I just kind of wanted to let you know what experience we have. There's one up there that we haven't mentioned so far, so I'm going to talk a little about that one as we go along, particularly when we get to the teacher professional development, and that's AT&T Connect. One thing we've had a different experience with is we've done the straight classroom to the library presentation, so to a school in Texas or to a school in Massachusetts, and we call that point-to-point for those that are not familiar with the jargon. So we've kind of done that direct route back and forth, and that's great. The other we've experimented more in the last 2 years has been multi-point, so different classrooms all at the same time. 6 or 7 classrooms in different parts of the country, all connected at the same time to us, and then they can all hear each other, can communicate with each other. So that's obviously, if you think about the technology, that's at a higher level, and it's a little more complicated, and you need help to do that generally. I know some of these guys have better equipment than we do. For the Truman Library to do that, we have to rely on people like my buddy James sitting next to me here. And he's going to tell you about how we did that. We couldn't do that. We connected to James, and then he connected us to all these other schools. And that's really incredible. It's very powerful. Just a couple of things about that, what we learned that was different than maybe doing it with a classroom presentation. I do a lot of classroom presentations in the greater Kansas City area, and we do a lot of document analysis and things like that. With the video conferencing, to use the general term, when you're doing that kind of engagement, with particularly with students, but maybe to a certain degree adults as well, they want to talk to you. They don't want to listen to your 45-minute lecture on Truman dropping the bomb or the Korean War or Truman Doctrine or what other fascinating session I decide to impart to them. They want to ask you questions. They want to tell you what they know. They want to analyze the material. So we've set it up a little differently. So rather than talking for 45 minutes like you might do if you're in a college lecture situation, we break it down. So within the first 10 minutes, not 20 minutes, within the first 10 minutes, everybody's had a chance to participate. It's really important because they're just champing at the bit, ready to go, because you've set up this two-way communication. It's very simple. But until somebody pointed that out to me, I was like, oh, wait a second, I didn't really thought about that. But they're on the edge of their seat, ready to, why is the period after the S in Harry Truman's name? Like, not again. But you have the opportunity to be the expert and answer that question. You are the expert when you're the other end of that camera. So you've really got to try and structure your presentation just a little bit differently. It's not that hard to do, but you want to try and introduce a level of engagement, back and forth, dialogue, as much as you can. So what we decided to do was to try and do some document analysis, but really try and do that so that they were going to do some feedback to you as we went along, and I'm going to get to that here in a second. A couple of other kind of feedback things. This is where the communication ahead of time, we probably could have done a better job of, probably. One thing we've learned is that the schools tend to stick to their schedule. You know, we're on at 10 o'clock, everybody. Okay, well, at 10:40, we've got to go to math. Wait a minute. We've spent all this time and met, and we're ready to go in Independence, Missouri, and you've got to go to math? Yeah, we've got to go to math. So you're going to kind of, they come into the field trip to the museum, they're there for 2 or 3 hours. If they come into our decision center, they're there for 5 hours. But sometimes you've got to set up those parameters, so we probably could have done a better job ahead of time saying, you know, you might want to set a little bit more time or give some time before and after. But a lot of the time, they're really sticking to that bell schedule. I know from being a former high school history teacher, that's important. The classroom teacher doesn't want to upset the administrators and get subs and all of that nonsense. So you've got to just think about that as you're doing your parameters. And then the senior groups, they like that interaction too. They all want, in our case, they always want to tell them when they met Harry Truman and their Truman story. And you have to build that into your time. You know, if you're going to do an hour, then you've got to give them 20 minutes to let them know when they shook Harry Truman's hand during the 1948 election, because that happened to every single person in your audience. I tend to be flippant, I'm sorry. Okay, so a couple of things. One, we use the technology to overcome an obstacle. As I mentioned, I'm at the Truman Library, and so as we were putting on our teacher conference, we're about to do our 11th annual teacher conference in July. Last year, when we were doing our 10th annual, we were right at the time of sequestration, and about 5 or 6 of my speakers were coming from presidential libraries. None of them were allowed to travel. None of them were allowed to travel. They're supposed to be coming to talk to 40 teachers in the Truman Library. So to do that, we had to do all of those particular presentations virtually. We had people on site who could come. They were scholars, historians, people who worked for foundations, non-for-profits, other experts. But over a 5-day workshop, we had 5 or 6 speakers that couldn't travel in. So for that, we used what we call AT&T Connect for that particular presentation. We didn't do video of the speakers, but they were able to share their screens. As has been mentioned, they were doing most of them were doing PowerPoint presentations. They sent us their primary source documents ahead of time, so they were physically in front of the teachers. And their audio came through a speakerphone in the room. So it felt a little bit like duct tape and scotch tape, and we made it work. And the interaction was good. They were able to do Q&A with the audience, with the teachers. Teachers are a little bit more forgiving because they use technology in the classroom every day, and they know that it can be a problem. But the AT&T Connect system was something that NARA was using anyway, so each of those presidential libraries had it. None of us had ever used it before, so everybody went through training. So we did test calls and all of those things to get it to work. And you could actually do a video component if you wanted to. We just, after a few test runs, we decided, you know, the jerkiness of anybody moving around. You've been on those calls, right? Somebody moves their head and you have the shadow that follows them. And so the connection wasn't particularly high speed, but the presentation was able to come through. They were able to do the Q&A and we made it work. With the Internet 2 project, James is going to talk particularly about that, the details of that and how that's set up. We were able to do these multi-point presentations to schools where we had multiple schools on all at the same time. I participated the last 2 years. The first year we did Berlin blockade, so we looked at documents and photographs and all different types of primary sources on the Berlin blockade. We had a really nice part of our website that has lots of those documents and photographs and so forth that the students were able to look at ahead of time. And then we highlighted a few key areas because we have about 1,000 documents online on that one topic alone. But we were able to narrow down these 6 pieces that we wanted them to look at. And then we went through an interactive session where they basically analyzed them and told me what they found in those documents. And then this last year in March, we did a session on the Truman Doctrine. We looked at the Truman Doctrine speech. They'd all been sent that ahead of time. They looked at some political cartoons. They looked at an oral history that we had online, a transcript of an oral history, and how in one weekend the draft of the Truman Doctrine speech was created before it even got to Truman's desk. But then they also got to see one change that Truman made that really elevated the Truman Doctrine to be a much more global policy, and they were able to see that within the documents. And within 45 minutes, they were able to realize the importance of Truman's role in that particular decision. The theme this past year for Primary Source Project was leaders in the time of crisis, and so that really fit in well for us. And then the last group that I wanted to mention were these retirement groups. They've come to us. We have not sought those groups out. They're a great audience. They're out there. They are desperate for programs, both physically and then virtually. And a lot of them are set up. Generally with them, the last few we've done have been using Zoom, which is basically just a laptop and a camera. We've done a couple where we've set up two connections, so we didn't have to switch back and forth, so we could have the PowerPoint running on one machine and have me on the video on the other and then do a picture-in-picture mode, which is kind of nice, so the speaker is always there in the corner, and they feel a kind of a better connection than just seeing the PowerPoint slides the whole time. So that's an avid audience that's out there. I think it's huge if you want to tap into that. It's really a highly engaged audience. And for us, a lot of nostalgia about the 40s and the 50s and so on, as I mentioned. So the last thing was kind of the surprising publicity that some of that has brought out. When we did the last Presidential Primary Sources Project with James and his group, we had groups from various parts of the country, and at the same time we had a group from Alaska, at the same time we had a group from Massachusetts simultaneously. So there are time zone issues there, but you know, when to connect and so forth, and the Alaska group gave us a hard time about that, about, you know, why have you done this at 9 o'clock central or 10 o'clock central or whatever time. But we did multiple presentations in one day to get around that. So, you know, the time commitment, if you're doing across the whole country, to do that more than once, don't always do it at the same time, things like that. But the Massachusetts newspaper, the screenshot there they put on their newspaper in North Adams, Massachusetts. So Adams being my last name, I thought that was kind of appropriate that they picked that up. But they put a nice article in the paper. It was unexpected publicity and promotion for the Truman Library, for the National Archives. And it's led to a lot of calls and emails about students and teachers that want to do the same thing. As you can see, our backdrop, we don't do the blue screen, but we have a nice meeting room that has a portrait of Truman and an American flag that we position strategically over my shoulder. So we have a nice backdrop. We've done a couple of mobile attempts. We also have a very busy museum. And we have a good footprint and lots of space, but we've done that a couple of times with grade school. So we're going to go back to that. I think now that we've got the laptop and we're thinking maybe an iPad might be a way to go to some of this. You know, we realize that's going to be a little jerky moving around. So that's something that we're going to experiment in the future. And I think the rest we can save for questions. Thank you very much. James.
Right, well, thank you all. It's a real honor and a privilege to join you at this conference and be participating in this panel, so thank you for the invitation to join. I was invited to come say a few words about the Presidential Primary Source Project, PPSP. I thought it just to provide a little bit of context, it might be helpful of the project, it might be helpful just to give a little bit of background on Internet 2, as well as the broader research and education networking community, just out of curiosity. How many of you would sort of claim to have a sort of a functional understanding of Internet 2 and what it's all about? And I mean a few of you. And I don't mean to put anybody on the spot here. It's certainly unintentionally become one of the, I think, our country's best kept secrets particularly in the education community. So I wanted to just provide a little bit of context around what Internet 2 is and what it can do, I guess, to help serve and complement your missions. So Internet 2 is a not-for-profit organization that was founded in 1996 by some leading higher education institutions. And if you recall, the higher education played a really, really important kind of foundational role in the birth story of the Internet. And when we rolled around through to around mid-90s, We kind of all remember what happened. The internet took off with the advent of the World Wide Web, development of the first web browser, and it became no longer just a sort of an intimate space for a few nerdy researchers to conduct data-intensive research in higher ed, but it sort of became co-opted by the unwashed masses. And so the folks that sort of helped develop the internet stood back and said, wait a minute, we just lost our baby. This is ours. This is our sort of a platform that we developed. You know what? We're just gonna. It's great that it's taking off in unexpected ways. It's becoming a commercial space now, a kind of a commodified space. But you know, we still need that same. We need the internet for the reasons we created it. So we'll just create another one, right? So they developed Internet 2. And it is, in fact, a separate physical internet that exists out there. It is something that parallels the existing commercial internet that we all use today, and, in fact, interoperates with that internet as well. It's based on the same networking protocols, et cetera, that we all know and love, or maybe we don't know, but we love. It just works. So that's exactly what they did. Mid-90s, the higher ed community, as well as you know, partners from industry and government, sort of that same partnership that gave birth to the internet, got together and formed Internet 2. So over the last 20-some-odd years, almost going on 20-some-odd years, they've slowly built this network and continued to mature it. But early on in the process, higher education institution, I think, had the foresight to realize that the internet is a wonderful thing, and it can serve many masters. One of them is education, and so rather than keep this new internet, this next generation internet, this place where we can innovate and expand and develop next generation technologies all to ourselves in higher ed, they said, you know what, we're going to open this up this time. Rather than wait 30 years for it to deploy out more broadly, we're going to, at the outset, we're going to say, everybody's welcome on Internet 2, on this next generation internet. We're going to extend access out to the broader education community, both formal and informal. So that includes everybody in this room is invited to the party. And many of you, whether you know it or not, are actually using Internet 2 right now. In your daily uses of the internet. So I won't bore you all and put you all to sleep with a lecture on networking. But safe to say, Internet 2 is in fact one of the fastest networks in the world. It is owned and operated by essentially all of us, given that it's a not-for-profit organization with the membership owns the infrastructure. And operates it. So it is kind of a still led, you can consider it still led by higher ed. They're the networking engineer, kind of geeky folks that make it all work. But it certainly is something that's available and to everybody. It's a non-commercial space. So it is kind of built from the ground up to serve research and education needs. So the other interesting point about Internet 2 and about this research and education networking community is that it's not something that's just sort of confined to the United States. Like the Internet itself, it is a global phenomenon by its very nature. And so what you see developing globally are similar efforts led by, predictably by higher ed institutions and industry and government partners in other countries as well. So while you have Internet 2 in the United States as our national research and education backbone network, you also have corollary efforts, parallel efforts in these other countries. And this is sort of a dated slide. So there's more blue, less gray. More and more, as you guess, the blue are the countries with these advanced networks. And there's less gray. There's actually more networks emerging and more interconnections between these networks. So in essence, what you're gathering, I'm sure, what we have here is a real opportunity. It is in many ways an unprecedented opportunity in that this infrastructure enables really unprecedented levels of collaboration and connects people in from diverse backgrounds, from diverse organizationally backgrounds, you know, personally, professionally, and organizationally. It ties us all together. And again, it's not a place to make money, buy and sell trinkets, and you know whatever. It's you know, put up videos of your cat doing interesting things or maybe not so interesting things. It's a place for hardcore research to be, data intensive research to be conducted, a place for the next generation scientific discovery to be made. It's an enabling kind of platform that in its essence ties us all together in ways that I don't think in our humanity we've ever had the opportunity to be as close as we are with something like this. So to me, that's an extremely exciting thing. So quickly, to give you a sense for who all is kind of connected to this infrastructure, am I already slapped down that 5 minutes for me? I feel like I just got started. So, all right, but keep me in line because I don't want to drift off into oblivion here. So just to give you a sense for how many organizations are connected to internet too, in one way, shape, or form, about 60% of the K-12 schools in this country are connected to one way or another to internet too. About 25% of all public libraries are connected to internet too. And the research and education networking community. About half of all the publicly funded community and technical colleges, and then, you know, goes without saying, all the big research universities and four-year baccalaureate universities are all part of the party as well. Now, what's exciting to me in particular is, and hopefully to all of you, is the fact that there are a growing number of museums, of science centers, of zoos, aquaria, historic sites that are connecting. Now, the last thing I'll say about Internet 2 and the R&E networking community before I move on to what I was asked to talk about is that not all these sites directly connect to this national backbone. That would be sort of like, you know, you see this super highway out here with 20 lanes. It'd be sort of like having, your house, the little paved or gravel driveway that you go out in and out of your house every day, connected to an 8-lane super highway, Eisenhower's, you know, interstate highway system. In fact, that doesn't make a lot of sense, not terribly scalable. So the way it's architected and the way individual museums, libraries, and all these institutions connect are through sort of mini versions, geographically smaller but every bit as powerful, networks that are kind of confined to a geographic area like a state or a region. And that's how individual schools, individual libraries then get connected. They connect to those state and regional ed networks, and then those state and regional ed networks then connect en masse to internet too. So just if you're curious how that works. So the question becomes, if we focus what is all this being in terms of formal and informal education? How does this align to all of our missions of trying to extend access to the legacy of presidential administrations, the good, bad, and the ugly, the primary source documents that you've all worked so diligently to digitize in their highest resolution and make available? Well, I think one answer to that question is found in this effort known as the Presidential Primary Source Project. It's a beautiful thing that it kind of goes to, I think, some of the points that former President Clinton was making to all of us last night around the importance of partnership and the importance of leveraging each other's strengths to do things that we may not be able to do alone, but together we can do amazing things. And that's exactly, I think, what makes this an interesting proposal in my mind. Is everybody that's coming to the table to be involved in this brings some unique set of skills that others need and rely on. But the thing that binds everybody together in this project is sort of a common mission, and the mission and goals that we all have at the end of the day are really closely aligned. So at any rate, the nature of this project is one where we're leveraging this great advanced infrastructure that I've been talking about to develop. What we ended up doing was, kind of, the research and education network community reached out and said, to NARA-funded presidential libraries, to national park historic sites, and other non-NARA-funded presidential libraries, et cetera. And we brought everybody kind of to the table and said, what could we do together? Well, let's do something. Let's test the limits of this networking capacity and do something interesting together. So we all together, kind of in partnership with teachers and educators around the country, struck on this idea of offering essentially what they are, 50 free, kind of free 50-minute video conferencing events. These are multi-point video conferencing events that involve schools and libraries all over the country connecting to a presidential historic site or presidential library, and around a topical theme that's tied to a set of curricular standards. So that gets the ear of the teachers out there. These days, they're extremely, I don't want to say slave, I think that's a little strong, but they're bound to teach to the standards. It's just culturally the pendulum sort of swung in that direction. And if you're not aligning your offerings to those standards, sort of what you're doing, no matter how diligently produced and interesting and helpful and useful to the teachers, they're simply just not going to, they're not going to know about it, or they're not going to be able to pay attention to it. So anyway, that was an important piece of this. So we tied these programs to standards. We chose a topical theme, and as Mark said, this year it was leadership in the time of crisis, and we just bundled this all up into hopefully as a digestible package, and aimed it right at middle school and high school students. So we kicked off the 2013-2014 academic year program series this year with an event happened in Plains, Georgia, and involved probably one of the ultimate presidential primary source. We had one here last night, and we had the pleasure of having another at that particular event. And I need to look at my notes to make sure I get this right. We were celebrating Carter's his environmental, his legacy of environmental conservation, and in particular, this was the anniversary of the signing of a really important piece of legislation that's not readily understood for those many of us. I learned a lot, but it's obviously a foundational act for the National Park Service. Nearly doubled its size, but this was celebrating both Carter's legacy of environmental conservation, but also the signing of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act into law in late 1980, just as Carter's stepping down.
We can hold the video and even play it during the lunch break.
Sure.
So that we can be sure to find time. Have we been able to connect with our team in North Dakota? Okay, so
right.
James, I definitely want to give some time to the video, and I think that the entire audience can benefit from watching that, but we want to make sure that we get to North
Absolutely.
Dakota as well.
Good call. So I guess at this point, we'll come back to those if time allows. Mm-hmm. And if not, they're online, and we can make sure you all can get access to them if we don't have, for whatever reason, not have time. So at this point, as Sean said, we're ready to bring in a real special treat, and we're all, as she said, we're all going to be students here. We're pretend we're in the classroom. We're high school students, and we're going to have
we're good high school students.
Hopefully,
we're the best.
And we're going to have I'll let Sharon go ahead and introduce and kind of give us a little bit of context about what we're about to experience here.
Sure, thank you. So the Theodore Roosevelt Center was one of the participants in PPSP the last 2 years, as was Mark. It's wonderful to meet you in person, Mark. We watch each other on the videos to kind of pick up pointers, but it's good to meet in person here. North Dakota was Roosevelt's second home, and that's why the Theodore Roosevelt Center is located there, and he often said that's where the romance of my life began. So we're very proud to be doing the work we're doing there. How many people have been to North Dakota in this room? Okay. Not a high percentage, you note. We're rather remote and hard to get to. And so projects like this, in collaboration with others, which I just want to affirm the importance of, have really been useful to us. and we're very grateful to be a partner. So what we did this year is we focused on two incidents in Roosevelt's life, one during his presidency and one after, the Russo-Japanese War and the negotiations around that, for which he won the Nobel Peace Prize, and then his activity surrounding World War I and his eagerness to participate in the war, and when he couldn't do that, sending his own children and encouraging the country to prepare and to participate as we could. So what you're going to see today is the first piece of that, the Russo-Japanese War. And again, we ask you to pretend you're a little younger than you are, and that you are the high school students in the classroom. And my colleague, Marlo Mallory Sexton, who gave this presentation about 2 weeks after I hired her, is going to actually present her portion of this, the portion on the Russo-Japanese War, and she will ask some questions and interact with you remotely, so you get an experience of that. Many of you have done webinars of various forms, but that two-way communication that Mark pointed out before is a very different experience, where you're actually seeing and talking back and forth, and you'll have that experience of wanting to talk that he talked about. That's really true. The students are engaged and wanting to interact, and so I'm going to let Marlo take it from here if our technology works, and let you have a little bit of an experience and a demo of how this works.
And bringing this together is a story in and of itself, so thank you.
Oh.
So let's play a game. I'm going to need one volunteer from your classroom, please. Preferably somebody with pen and paper. One volunteer?
No volunteer.
All right, we've got a volunteer here. You and your class have 30 seconds to make a complete list of all the leadership roles you can think of that Theodore Roosevelt had during his lifetime. At the end of 30 seconds, I'm going to ask our volunteer here to report back with the number of leadership roles you could all come up with. Brainstorm, ready to go. 30 seconds, 1, 2, 3, go.
All right, so we're brainstorming the number of leadership roles that the president is responsible for.
Oh, Theodore Roosevelt during his whole lifetime.
Secretary of the Navy.
He did something in New York City.
Wasn't he chief of police in New York?
Rough Rider.
Rough Rider.
Hunting expedition.
Father.
10 seconds.
He had to go down the river? Okay.
Somebody said mediator.
Businessman.
Vice president.
Vice president. Naturalist. Assistant Secretary of the Navy.
Up.
We got it.
Phew.
Time's up.
Wow, that was pretty good. What was the complete number? Do we have a list?
I lost track.
50.
50. Bad high school student.
You got your Theodore Roosevelt stuff down, or Sharon was giving you the answers.
Hmm.
Can I ask, what was the very first thing on that list?
Governor. Down.
Governor, okay, interesting. And that was one of the many leadership roles that led him into being the president that we remember and are kind of celebrating today. As president, presidency tops the list of Theodore Roosevelt's leadership roles. Roosevelt's attention was divided between a lot of issues. We recognize him as a leader in the United States for consumer protection laws, labor laws, and the conservation of our natural resources. But he also focused on what kind of international power our country was becoming. In the early 1900s, Roosevelt would always prioritize the welfare of the United States during his presidency from 1901 until 1909, but he was also looking around at the other countries around the world, sometimes policing their activities and keeping an eye on the power of other nations. He would call peace when he thought it was necessary, and try to balance the powers around the world during this time period in the early 1900s. One historian stated, though, that Roosevelt, quote, had hopes of some momentous event whose resolution would enable him to stand with Washington and Lincoln in the pantheon of American heroes. And a momentous event occurred in the form of an unusual international crisis right in the middle of Roosevelt's presidency. We're lucky enough to have a cartoonist who left behind some clues about what that international crisis was. So I'm going to ask for perhaps the same volunteers again to help us look at this cartoon and figure out a little more about this international crisis Roosevelt helped to resolve. All right. Can I have a volunteer who wants to help me analyze this cartoon? I'll ask you a couple of questions. The first thing I see is that this looks like a magazine cover. Can you read me what is the title of this cartoon?
Looks like Puck is at the top, but I can't read what's at the very bottom.
It's hard to read that.
All right. It is a little bit tough to see these screens sometimes. The cartoon is called The Old Salt Salute. And the old salt would be Poseidon, the god of the sea, coming out and saluting somebody. Can you see who he's saluting?
A soldier on a submarine.
A soldier on a sub.
Okay, and what country is that soldier representing?
Japan.
Japan.
The Empire of Japan.
Yeah. Now you can kind of see in the background here what happened to another country. What does it look like happened in the background?
Smoke.
All right. Yeah, it kind of looks like maybe a torpedo attack occurred. And so who do we think is the winner of this attack or this very first battle?
Japan.
Country whose flag is sinking or Japan in the front?
Japan.
Japan.
All right. Excellent. This magazine is from March 2nd of 1904. 1 month before this cartoon was published, the Russo-Japanese War had begun with a surprise naval attack on Russia. Before the war had even started, though, politicians in Europe and Asia had tried to prevent the war from happening. What followed was more than a year of battles on land and sea. Now, I will tell you that in the middle of this war, our President Theodore Roosevelt asked if Russia and Japan would agree to have him mediate a negotiation, make them come to some kind of peace terms, but he was refused at first. The war continued, and the war had its cost. One battle in particular had as much as 150,000 casualties. That's like 3/4 of the population of Little Rock, Arkansas. Russia was on the brink of political revolution. Japan's navy was exhausted and becoming broke. So by 1905, neither nation should have been continuing the war. Neither nation could afford to continue the war. By May of 1905, Japan came back to Theodore Roosevelt and asked if they could take him up on that offer to mediate a peace. Now, in line with Theodore Roosevelt's personality, you bet he was off on a hunting trip when that request to make peace came through. He cut his hunting trip short and returned back to Washington to take care of business. Now, you might expect international business like this would be taken care of by the Secretary of State, but Roosevelt had a problem. His Secretary of State was becoming deathly ill and resigned from his position while this crisis was happening. So it only made sense that President Roosevelt dealt with all of this pretty much on his own and with his closest, most trusted advisors. Roosevelt knew just how to deal with these two very proud nations, though. After accepting Japan's request to mediate a peace, TR now had to get Russia to agree and make it look like it was the other country's idea in both situations. All these agreements were done confidentially, and in a letter to his daughter, Roosevelt explained how difficult this process was. Let's take a look at this letter. Here, Roosevelt, recalling all of this peace negotiations, wrote to his daughter later that year and said near the bottom, "Whenever I wrote a letter to the Tsar, the Russians were sure." I'm amused to see the way in which the Japanese keep silent. Whenever I wrote a letter to the Tsar, the Russians were sure to divulge it, almost always in a twisted form. But the outside world never had so much as a hint to any letter I sent to the Japanese. The Russians became very angry with me during the course of these proceedings because they thought I was only writing to them. Japan had accepted Roosevelt's assistance. Russia eventually accepted. Both sides had agreed to meet, but the big question was, where would they agree to meet? Roosevelt suggested The Hague, where international peace had been made several years before. But the two nations involved would only agree on one place. They would only agree on Washington, D.C. Now, let me ask you, how many of you have been to Washington, D.C.? How many of you have been to Washington, D.C. in the summertime? Okay. So you know that it's a little bit hot and humid in the summertime. And that's one of the many reasons why Theodore Roosevelt didn't want to have a meeting at Washington, because he wasn't going to be there. Roosevelt, like so many presidents, spent his summers away. His summer White House was the Roosevelt Estate at Sagamore Hill in Oyster Bay, Long Island. Here is our picture of Sagamore Hill from our digital collection. And you can see that very popular veranda on the front that characterizes that house. Well, even at this time, 1905, the media was on top of the international news. One cartoonist suggested how the negotiations might take place and where they might take place. Let's take a look at a cartoon from this time period. Multiple panels. What we see in the middle is Theodore Roosevelt sitting on the veranda of Sagamore Hill with his personal assistant, William Loeb, and representatives from both Japan and Russia. I'm going to ask a volunteer here to help me analyze this cartoon a little bit. We can use the same volunteers if we've only got one classroom to work with. So there's Theodore Roosevelt on the porch talking to the representatives. I will tell you that these representatives would carry the full power of making decisions for their emperor and their nation. They would be called plenipotentiaries. Keep that in mind as we break down this cartoon. Can I ask our volunteer, what is the title of this little poem?
To the Teddy Potentiaries.
Those would be the representatives working with Theodore Roosevelt. We're going to skip the poem right now, though, and jump to one of our panels in the cartoon. I want to look at this panel, and I want to ask you a couple of questions. Number one, what is the issue they're trying to settle? You might want to read the caption and then decide, what is the issue they're trying to settle in this cartoon?
The question of indemnity.
Yes. Japan was asking Russia to pay them back for the costs of war, and this would be a key point in the negotiations that had to be made. So, in this cartoon, how are they going to settle it?
Tennis match.
Badminton.
Yes. And do you see Theodore Roosevelt in this cartoon? What is he doing?
Watching.
Keeping the score.
Yeah, he's the ref.
Yeah, he's calling the shots and keeping the score. Now, does this look like a good way to settle international crises?
Maybe not.
Maybe not. I don't know if it's ever been done, so maybe it does work, but that's what our cartoonist thought should happen.
Hey, Marlo?
Yeah.
Just wanted to let you know, we are getting close on time, and so we got started a little bit late with some technological issues, which is part of why we need to have this conversation, and we wanted to make sure that we had time for the people in the room to ask us questions and also to ask you some questions. So if you don't mind hanging on, we wanted to see if anyone has questions about the technology, the ability and need to be flexible, and why that is such an important part of what we wanted to convey to you, or any of the different resources that we have shared with you this morning. Yes, right up here.
The single question, mainly because I think the hordes will be coming for dinner soon.
The hordes will be coming through.
For lunch.
And we will be available to continue to take your questions, but we wanted to get maybe two questions, because we did get a late start, Bob.
Okay.
You weren't
here for
that.
It's up to you.
Okay.
Yes, for the young lady
on the video screen. Marla. This is Duke Blackwood from the Reagan Library. How do the kids accept this technology? Are they engaged in it, or are they like a normal high school that won't pay attention?
In the experience that I had working with James so far, it really depends on if the teacher is familiar with the technology, and I'm going to assume with the class itself. I have seen them sort of, you know, get disconnected by not having somebody directly in front of them, and half class was allowed to walk away, the others were staying in front of the screen. So I think it really depends on the classroom, like so many other factors.
Anybody else? Address that too.
I would just say that in the most cases, I think they're more engaged. The fact that they've set up a time, they have a guest speaker. You go and speak, particularly if you do some interaction, you will lose them quicker if you're not going to do, if you just lecture for 40 minutes. But in my case, when you've gone back and forth with them, particularly in the fashion that you saw in the example at the beginning, within the first 5 minutes or so, then you increase that level of engagement immediately.
I also want to add that we've been really interested to see that groups that we perceived to be not paying very much attention, because all we could see was them on the screen, at the end and throughout, they would start to ask really good questions and clearly had been paying attention. So there are some funny things about the perception you have when you see people on screen that, you know, don't always think that they're not paying attention, just because you're going to have a very different relationship to them when they're on screen.
And one thing I'll add to that is, if you're not on internet too, there can be a lag between when you ask that question and when you get a response back, so you have to be prepared to allow that wait time for them to kind of get the content, process it in their classroom, and then respond out. But from what I'm seeing with internet too, it seems a lot faster. What we ultimately today ended up connecting with Marlo via Skype, because just it ended up being, as we talked about options, it ended up being the best option for connecting from the Clinton Center today. Other questions? Yes.
The value of being able to interact with the students is obvious, but for those of you who use documents in your work, I'd imagine there could be some problem with legibility or the lack of ability to zoom in to get the students to be able to read what you're asking them about. So which of these technologies are the best for doing that?
Well, one of the things around that is, if you've got people signing up ahead of time, so you have an email address, you can send them the documents ahead of time so they have a classroom set in front of them. That's by far better than anything you can do in terms of technology, as long as you've got a good scan and you can send them what I do is I compile them all into one PDF and then send them, and then the teacher will either have the students print them, you know, we make handouts. That's going to be better than any technology. Yeah. Otherwise, you need that fast connection.
The other thing I add is, if you have the capacity, consider investing in a document camera, which can significantly improve.
Document cameras are helpful.
Which you can attach to your other equipment, and it can significantly improve the first year. Relation.
We just didn't want to plug another device in.
Yeah.
James, any thoughts on that?
No, yeah.
Document camera, definitely. Go ahead.
Yeah, and one of the things that we've done is to provide a transcript. You know, because Jackson, his handwriting was not great. So, you know, it's helpful to maybe have an option where they can see the document, but you send something along with it that provides the actual transcript of what he's writing.
The key, though, is that good teaching is good teaching in some ways. So the kind of interactivity that you would really hope exists in a classroom needs to exist times two when you're not in the classroom with them. So just, you know, the lecture format is going to disengage in either setting.
Because you may as well throw in a DVD if you're not going to engage with them and get them. We get them up and moving and trying to kind of model the position that Lee Harvey Oswald is in some of the famous kind of backyard photo images with the rifle, and see if they can get in that position, because that photograph has been questioned as to whether or not it's been doctored. And so we ask them, you know, is this a normal position? How does that feel? And, you know, that just gets them out of their seats and involved in the conversation, so that it's not a one-way, it is a two-way conversation that we're having with them. Well, we have put our slides up on Internet too, on the Muse site. There is a link that we are happy to make available to this group, and we can share out through ASLH and through the Internet 2 table out here. And we are certainly available for additional questions if you have them. And James, you have one final point?
Oh, just I was just going to, if this presidential primary source project has piqued any of your interest, there seems to be a consensus amongst those that have participated last year and the year before and a lot of the schools and teachers they'd like to do it again. And so we'll be planning that program starting this summer. And I just wanted to welcome each and every one of you representing your site. If you're at all interested, we would absolutely love to have you come on board and participate as a content provider in next year's program. And
we have a sign-up list if you wish to learn more and to get information about this. And some of us have some handouts if you are interested in finding out more about the educational programs that we're doing. So thank you very much for your time. Thank you, Bob, for giving me the... and thank you, Marlo, in North Dakota.
Thank you, Marlo.
I'm going to do instructions from the back of the room this time, but I do want to mention a tweet that B-Sharp4 sent. Circuit breaker trips. Slide of Lee Harvey Oswald is on the screen during breakout sessions on technology. Conspiracy theories abound. Lunch is outside. We'll be leaving around 2 o'clock in and around to get to Central High School this afternoon.